This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, a scholar and activist says support for prison and police reform actually amounts to propping up these racist institutions. And the mayor of New York City claims turnstile jumping has nothing to do with poverty.
But first, last summer, the voters in Jackson, Mississippi, elected Antar Lumumba mayor of the overwhelmingly black city. Antar Lumumba is the son of the late activist Chukwe Lumumba. Some folks are already describing Jackson as the most radical city in the country, a very premature assessment. We spoke with Kali Akundo, an activist with Cooperation Jackson, a community self-help organization that is trying to establish cooperative enterprises owned by the local workers.
I think the biggest challenge for us is clearly articulating a program that makes sense to folks and then being able to demonstrate in practice that the program can work to improve the living condition. And then you have to do that with limited resources, right? Because it's not like Cooperation Jackson is loaded with, you know, a lot of money and resources. And so trying to pull folks together to combine what little resources they have to actually move on a program, you know, that's going to take some time and energy. And I think we've made a little bit of progress in that regard over the past 4 years. But we got a long way to go, I think, to get to what we aim to be. And then as regards to being under a Democratic administration, you know, there are some aspects of kind of a broad united front against the forces of just outright reaction and white supremacy that I think we can count upon, you know, to be in unity and be in some lockstep with people within the kind of the political class, if you will, to work in some unity with a broad program and the broad vision that we're trying to bring forward. But we are also in the era of neoliberalism. We are fighting also to get those same political forces to not concede to the dictates of big business, to the corporations, to capital, and to not make concessions that bend towards privatization, weaken the ability of working people to exercise their rights, to have decent wages, to have decent working conditions, to fight against austerity, you know, and because neoliberalism and finance capital are so dominant, many of those forces are constantly trying to figure out how to extract the best deal that they can from capital, but they got very little leverage to work with. So what we are trying to do the best we can is constantly pose an alternative to the city and to the politicians in the city that says that there are other ways to go. There are other routes to choose rather than the path of austerity, the path of privatization, the path of cuts. And it will take really some bold vision and some bold activism to get us there. But just bowing to their will is not the only solution. So that type of education, that type of encouragement, if you would, and mobilizing and pushing is a core part of what our program is and what it really has to be if we want to see certain broad kind of systemic changes toward the transformation of the economy and the transformation of the social conditions. We've got a lot of work to do in that regard. But beyond just convincing them, there's still a question of building a mass movement here that is proactive rather than reactive. And what do I mean by that? You know, like one of the things that I think has been good and a strength here, you know, leading to things that people see as victories. There's a strength to bringing forces together against the different kind of dictates of white supremacy that come down from the Tea Party and the neo-Confederates. But trying to get our people and the broad alliance of forces to actually be for something and to be for something without compromise, you know, at least not compromising that's going to damage the integrity of what you're trying to move, that's a little bit harder. And I think that's the stage where we're at right now, is trying to build a broad consensus of advancing a radical program that's going to build strength, particularly for the Black working class. I think that's the kind of educational, positional struggle we're in right now.
Cooperation Jackson's been focused on the task of building cooperative enterprises, including in the high-tech sector. And Cooperation Jackson has been associated with the current residents of City Hall, although the two are separate. How much cooperation has Cooperation Jackson gotten from the Antar Lumumba administration? And what has been the attitude of the large, overwhelmingly Republican-dominated state of Mississippi?
Well, the Republican-dominated legislature and the governor, I mean, they're very clear about what they want to do to Jackson, let alone Cooperation Jackson or the administration of Chokwe Antar Lumumba. And their program is basically to recapture the city, point blank, period. And they want and mean and intend fully to dispossess the Black working class of the city, meaning push us out, scatter us to the winds, to reclaim what they see as their capital. And they're not going to make too many significant investments in the city unless they're kind of assured of a demographic shift and a power shift in the city. So in that regard, we need to be clear that those forces don't see any distinction between center or left in the Black community. To them, we are equally problematic and equally the enemy. And so they're very clear about what their program is and how they're moving it forward piece by piece, block by block. One of the things that we are staring down here now that your audience should be aware of, it looks like a major step toward the privatization of education is going to pass here in Mississippi this legislative session, with the introduction of the school voucher program, which is going to allow folks to basically send their kids to private schools, which will enable the rich primarily to take public funds and stop paying or at least a portion of their child's tuition in these private institutions. But it's also going to mean you have a lot of folks who have stayed out of the public school system in the state are going to kind of reenter back into it so that they can therefore send their kids to private schools and these Christian and religious schools, which is a major step toward privatization. One of the things that they're trying to do is just dismantle any kind of public institution, but particularly those public institutions which benefit Black people in any way, and that being one of them, right? So they're very clear about what they want to do. I think the question is, again, what I was alluding to a minute ago, is how do we build a broad enough unity and consistent unity in the program to move some things forward. And the center forces and the left forces in the Black community, particularly here in Jackson, I think we got some work to do and some struggle to continue to be ways to get on the same page in regards to that. And what a lot of the differences kind of currently lie is who you collaborate with, why you collaborate with them, and then under whose terms. What's the terms of compromise, in essence? What are we willing to compromise? What are we not willing to compromise? What base of strength do we have to kind of dictate the terms or modify the terms that are being largely enforced upon us? And then I think more important, if we can unite, then what terms are we trying to set in reverse? Like, how do we go on the advance? These are some of the questions that we have to really, I think, grapple with in a deep way.
Well, what kind of questionable compromises do you think are in the offing?
Well, for me, this is me, Kali, as an individual. I think the era of compromise on a certain level is over. I think we've been backed so far into a corner in general over the last 40 plus years by capital that there's very little left for our side of the equation to bargain with other than our life. They coming for that, too. So I think we need to flip the terms around and say, no, we're not going to compromise on any form of privatization. We're not going to compromise on any form of austerity. And it's not just a position of compromise. Now, you know, what we call in broad with Cooperation Jackson, going back to the collective, a build and fight program. And the build portion of it is the thing that we feel that we have to really implement and put a lot of emphasis on. Because if we're going to take bold moves to not like compromise, you know, we need to be real about how we're going to secure basic needs and necessities of our community. And for me, I think that calls for the city. Now, as an individual, saying that you need to be prepared for that by being willing to execute a radical program. And that for me, that means, like, to start off with food sovereignty, to give an example, food sovereignty, I think, is a key thing in this struggle. If we're going to really wage battle, we need to make sure that we can take care of the basic kind of nutritional caloric needs of our folks. And in Jackson, we right now, in most people's mind, we have the problem of major blight, a lot of, you know, vacant land and abandoned houses. Well, let's flip that. And I say in my suggestion as an individual is to say, let's turn that into an asset. And it's going to require a cultural shift for it. But what I mean by asset, let's put all of that to use, as much of it as we can, towards producing some large communal farms that start to take care of our basic kind of caloric needs and create a new kind of social dynamic that's a little bit beyond your normal market dynamics, and have the city and the social movements in town play a leading role in doing this kind of food sovereignty program. And that secures a firm basis with our own resources, our own skills, our own talents to remove a critical threat that can be used against us and will be used against us.
And that raises the question of how much collaboration mm-hmm. is necessary for that project from the city, and what kind of hostility have you gotten or do you anticipate from the state?
I expect maximum hostility. That's the bottom line for me as an individual. I expect maximum hostility. Because anytime you take any kind of concrete step toward liberating yourself, the forces that benefit from your exploitation and subjugation, you know, they're going to push back with equal, if not greater force, because it's already at their disposal to use it, both legally and physically, right? That's why you're in the position that you're in. So you got to anticipate that. In terms of collaboration, I think it's more of a question, you know, starts to become a question, how much do we believe in the people and the people's capacity and will to struggle for their own liberation? And I think some of the differences lie in our different approaches towards what the people are prepared to do. And from my vantage point, I don't expect necessarily people to go full on, for instance, staying with that example. I don't expect people to fully understand the need off the surface towards moving towards a radical program around food sovereignty. But I think you got to pose all the questions forthrightly. Like, if we take a step towards breaking free from being dependent upon the state government or being subject to the state government, you know, we are going to need to make sure that we take care of our basic necessities as a community. We got to feed ourselves. We got to provide for water for ourselves and a basic level of security for ourselves. Raise those as mass questions to the community so people can debate that through. This is what I think we got to go to and ask the people.
And in terms, again, of the city's role in this, if it chooses to have one.
I think we got to keep encouraging the city to see this. And I think in many respects, it's a question of being an agent of good governance, as that's currently articulated, versus being an organizing vehicle, right? Most cities don't see themselves as agents of change. You know, that's not how the liberal bourgeois structure is set up. And what I think we are trying to put forward on a broad way is to say, let's think of governance in a new way. And what I'm asking for more or less as an individual is to say, you know, number one, if you're going to get elected to mayor or city council or anything like that, I think you got to walk in there with the perspective of you are not there to manage the contradictions of capitalism. Because number one, they can't be managed, not from your position, not from your vantage point. And can you go in there and be an advocate to push the contradictions to a greater extent? And I think you do that by trying to become, in effect, an organizer and an agitator over and above kind of an administrator and somebody who's just trying to govern the various kind of dynamics of paving roads and making sure that there's public safety. I think you got to turn all those dynamics on their head and really raise a lot of critical questions about how the system functions and who it functions for, and raise those as mass questions to enable as much energy and pushback from the community, from the people as possible to change the social relationships, to change the political relationships, and I think most important, start to change the material relationships, who owns what and why, and to what end, you know, is it used for? And I think this is a tall question that most folks, I don't know, necessarily be ready for, because following the path I just laid out is definitely not your traditional path to get reelected. It definitely puts you on the conflict of trajectory. And, you know, we have to, I think, do a lot of work in the social movement to get ourselves and those we kind of try to propel to take those roles to deal with those contradictions and that level of conflict.
But even on the level of governance or good governance in terms of policing, serious questions have been raised about the new administration's failure to call a halt to police killings of Black folks in Jackson.
Yeah, and then there's some growing attention that's being paid to this, at least that I know many folks in the community that we have relationships with, where they're starting to question. And I think we got to question it. One of the big things that, as you know, and I hope your audience knows, if they don't know, to get introduced to, you know, one of the key components of the Jackson-Cush plan that we've been promoting for years is to make Jackson a human rights city. And one of the reasons why we were pushing and will continue to push that so hard is to deal with this question of police and what their role is or should be, if at all, in the community. And these killings have really brought this question to the fore. And I think, number one, the administration is trying to figure out how it should relate to the police on their own terms. You know, they're clearly trying to struggle through that and figure that out. But I think from our vantage point, what we are saying in this case is more of the Jackson Human Rights Institute, is this, what has happened this last couple of months, only justifies the need for a human rights charter and for that to be implemented immediately, drafted and implemented immediately. And a core component of that charter is to create a real police monitoring instrument, which is democratically elected by the people, not something appointed by city council, not something appointed by the mayor, but something that's an elected position. And that this position would be part of this human rights monitoring body that we create, what we call the Human Rights Commission. And that commission would have not only the power to subpoena, but to have the power to hire, fire, and to take folks to court and other legal proceedings to make sure that our human rights are, as we say, respected, protected, and fulfilled. And this is an obligation that we want to put forward to the entire city council, to the administration, to say, you need to enact on this now and get ahead of it. Now, we have an opportunity, I think, in Jackson to demonstrate how you can actually put this instrument of violence, which is what the police are, a means of enforcing the existing social order, however just or unjust it may be. Like, that is their role. Let's put this vehicle in check immediately, and let's move forward with our politics and our principles to do that. So this is a piece that we are beginning to raise now with the current administration and say, you got to tackle some of these issues and move on the basis of the principle around the human rights charter that we know in principle that you agree with. Now let's figure out a way together on how to implement it so that no more of our people are killed and gunned down in the street and treated by the police to be anything less than human. And we got to find ways to resolve these conflicts, because we've had, three or four people have died as a result of some of these police shootings that have taken place in Jackson since October. And just raise the question of, if these mass killers can walk away unscathed from these shootings by the police, we should find some way to treat everybody in the community the same way. Right. That's more than just a question of training. It's a deeper question of policy, a deeper question of how they exercise what power has been granted to them to be these enforcers that I spoke about. So we definitely going to raise this, because, you know, no more Black people need to be killed in the city where there's a Black administration and largely a Black police force. We can and have to do better. And I think for us, we're saying this starts with this charter and starting to change the balance of power and how that power is used and enforced to control the police, you know, quite frankly. That's a critical thing that I think we're going to put forward. And I think it's going to be a challenge and a test because, you know, the state, that's another area where the state is going to push back. And I'm quite sure the federal government is going to push back in a lot of respects. And so it then becomes a question again of how do we build the types of alliances with all the progressive forces in town to be able to kind of implement a vision that we all share. And that's a challenge and something that we all are trying to learn. In Jackson over the past 10 plus years, I think we took some decent steps towards building a decent program. And I think now we are at a phase where there has to be a maturity of that unity and a shared vision on how you implement those things that lead in a more radical direction. And I think time will tell whether our practice will live up to getting us to that point. So I would encourage everybody to stay tuned to what's going on the next couple of weeks and months as we all are struggling to try to figure this out.
Yes, of course, black folks get killed in huge numbers in cities that have black mayors and largely black city councils and black police chiefs and largely black police forces. But folks who are now sitting in City Hall in Jackson certainly talked a lot like you before they got in City Hall. Do you sense that this administration might feel it should be immune from real community control of the police?
I would hope that they don't feel immune to that. I would hope that they draw upon the militant cloth in history that they come from and put that front and center in the actual construction of policy and the implementation and enforcement of policy. But I think time will tell. You know, one of the things that, you know, we've seen time and time again throughout history, which is something I think the left in general just has to try to figure out, is once we enter into the bourgeois state, how much accommodation of it can we avoid? And that's a deep question. I don't know if any of us have the answer to. I think it's just a constant struggle to how you continue to implement your program, the program that you walked in with. How do you continue to implement that? And how do you do it in such a way that you don't make compromises that you can't recover from, number one, and that you are moving your base in accordance with the principle and not alienate your base, you know, because that's part of what the overall game is played, and particularly how capital tries to play radical forces as they come into it. One of the first things they try to do is separate you from your base. They try to do it by putting forth a number of different things that, you know, basically strangling you, saying that if you don't bend to my will, I'll divest from your city, or I'll retract this resources, or I'll make sure you don't get this funding, or make sure you don't get that. And I think the only way you really can overcome those types of threats, and those threats are real, you got to have a real solid program and the belief and the means to carry it out. And I think not just here, but I think we've seen time and time again, gaps emerge between the social movement and the forces that those social movements propel one way or another into these elected offices. And how do we continue to move our programs forward, both inside and outside, is a challenge that I think we're all constantly trying to figure out.
That was Kali Akundo of Cooperation Jackson.
People that petition and agitate for reform of the police and the mass black incarceration system may actually be bolstering the power of those racist institutions. Dr. Dylan Rodriguez, a professor of media and cultural studies at the University of California at Riverside, says reformers tend to legitimize the very systems they criticize, as opposed to those who would abolish prisons and reinvent the way communities are made secure. Professor Rodriguez authored an article for Black Agenda Report titled Mass Incarceration as Police Endorsement. He understands that some reformers might be insulted at being described as allies of police and prisons.
Part of this is getting at the word you used, insult. The premise of one pushing for mass incarceration reform being insulted by not even an accusation, but just the descriptive reassertion of the fact that this reform platform pivots on a buttressing of police power, as well as a reform of police power, but a buttressing and expansion of police power generally as the context to reduce mass incarceration. That's the fact of the symbiosis between these two forms of racist state violence. It's always been, since the frontier and chattel slave era, it's always been a kind of somewhat delicate and sometimes dysfunctional vacillation in relationship, but a general symbiosis. Generally, it's a symbiotic relationship between the racist state violence, the gendered racist state violence of policing, and the gendered racist state violence of incarceration. Whether now, and I'm saying that whether we think about incarceration as a reservation, a plantation, as apartheid segregation, or as jail and prison. There's always been this historical need to premise U.S. white supremacist nation building on a general symbiosis between policing people of color, indigenous people, slave Africans, and others, and containing them, spatially containing them, and then isolating them into conditions of apartheid or effective apartheid. So part of what I'm trying to do nowadays is obsessively describe to people, rather than argue to people, really just describe to people the fact that this kind of emergence of mass incarceration reform as a kind of expanding liberal common sense discourse is actually something which, both on the face of it and in the weeds of its policy agenda, pivot on a strengthening of police force. And also, importantly, a strengthening of police force that also is accompanied by a condemnation of the most spectacular and allegedly illegal forms of police violence, which people usually name police brutality. But as things wind their way through different district attorney and court systems, are oftentimes actually not police brutality. They're fully endorsed or at least condoned by the legal system and by internal affairs and by internal investigations. So we can't call these things police brutality. They're simply what they are. They're policing. So this is the delicate balance that has historically kind of generated the gendered racist order of the United States and the form of state violence that it takes in different periods. And we're in a period now. And that's what I'm just trying to amplify to people, that this reformist agenda around mass incarceration is really about a kind of pivot away from incarceration and toward policing, expanded, friendlier, but more massive and penetrating forms of policing.
Yes, reform of slavery, even if it reduced the use of the whip, would still leave slavery intact. And you're saying, I believe, that much of so-called police reform does not challenge the essential relationship of police to the people.
No, to the contrary. You'll see repeatedly in both the public statements and the verbal orations of those who push police reform a constant reassurance to the public, and it's implicitly always a white public, that their reform agenda is not about discrediting the police. It's not about attacking the police. It's not about endorsing self-defense against the violence of the police. In fact, what they are actually doing is that they want the police to be stronger, to be more legitimated, to be more normalized, and oftentimes to be more embedded in precisely the same communities that they are policing, meaning poor, Black, brown, indigenous, aboriginal communities. And so it's actually to the contrary. It's the fact that police reform is premised on a repeated, almost incessant ideological assurance that the police are absolutely a central apparatus of the United States nation building project, that they are indispensable and that social order is inconceivable without them. So it's actually far worse than we sometimes want to believe it is.
Yes, they're always saying that they don't believe that all police are bad, which essentially means that they think the problem is that there are a few bad police.
Yes, and this is part of the problem with the political narratives and rhetorics that we use. We say police brutality to talk about forms of police violence that are fully sanctioned by the state. Therefore, by definition, they are not police brutality. They are simply police procedure. They are police protocol. They are everyday policing. In the same breath, we want to use the phrase mass incarceration when we all know that it's not the masses in the undifferentiated way that are actually being criminalized and incarcerated. There was a period of time when Black radical communities and other abolitionist communities during the latter 90s and early 2000s would use the phrase mass incarceration. We all understood what we meant. We all understood that we were talking about particular communities that were targeted for criminalization en masse. The way that the kind of liberal common sense has kind of appropriated and kidnapped this phrase has snuck in a post-racial ideology through the back door, where what they're trying to nurture and foster is a liberal white humanist concern around the scourge of incarceration. The fact is, it's really maybe not mass incarceration. Maybe what it actually is, it's a form of gendered racist domestic war that pivots on incarceration as one of its main modes of combat. So it's not mass. It's targeted. It's selective. It's geographically and community focused, focused on particular people, behaviors, particular gender racial profiles. That's what it is. And so to the extent that we allow this rhetoric to gain hegemonic presence, we don't challenge it, then we're in trouble. We have to challenge this rhetoric every step of the way and insist that this is actually the wrong phrase. And what concerns me about it is that increasing numbers of Black and brown activist communities have fallen back on this term and this concept, mass incarceration, as well as police brutality, as their default language. I think we need to challenge that, and we need to challenge each other to use more precise language.
Yeah, the term in vogue these days is community policing. And when folks are asked to explain exactly what that entails, we find that it includes massively increased intelligence gathering data on the community, the co-optation of community organizations. Some would say just outright snitching.
Yes, really, in some ways, this is in continuity with the notorious counterintelligence program, which was premised on illicit infiltration of communities and penetration of their grassroots revolutionary and liberation movement organizations. Well, we're at a moment right now of reaction and proto-white nationalist fascism in which the desire to generalize the everyday behavior and the mentality, the brain focus of policing to everyone in the community has become one of the most insidious, subtle, and damaging kind of rearticulations of that white nationalist proto-fascist ideology. It's about spreading that mentality of policing one another, policing space, and of waging domestic war into ordinary folks in the community who are actually themselves fighting against external policing from occupying forces.
You'd like a re-examination of the term reform, but it seems that what's also in need of re-examination and possibly disuse is the term policing itself, that we need to get away from that term and figure out a better one.
It's domestic war, Glenn. That's what it's always been. From the rise of the modern police force, it's always been about some form of geographic, racial, domestic war. That's the whole point was, from the very beginning, it was about policing and protecting property, whether the property was enslaved people, whether the property was the more typical notion of brick and mortar property, or whether the property entailed spatial ownership, meaning the policing of boundaries, such as in the frontiers, in the segregated apartheid city. So from the very beginning, policing has always been about an assurance that notions of community security and public safety were actually about waging war against particular peoples, particular neighborhoods, particular ways of being, particular bodies. So I'll say this, if we choose to engage in the language that utilizes the term policing, we at least need to frame it as one of the tactical and institutional fronts of an ongoing domestic war that actually constitutes the making of and the remaking of the United States every single day, every single week, every single year.
But in terms of the conversation of people who actually want to change the system, we should avoid the use of this term policing and speak in terms of security for the community and maybe come up with some different kind of terminology.
Yes, sir. That is the abolitionist imperative. That is the black radical imperative. That is the anti-colonial imperative. Is that if we're going to really talk in real terms, in deep terms, in historical terms about our collective safety, about your and my bodily protection, about the protection of our elders, the youngsters, and all the kin, then we need to understand that there is no way in which we can tolerate the existence of a police force the way that we have come to know it in the modern United States. That is absolutely correct. So there is no reforming the police, Glenn. In every stage, the reforming of police, criminal justice, and prisons and incarceration has always entailed a sophistication and expansion of those very same institutions. So even the current moves against fatal police violence that attempt to hold police accountable to their own violence in these kind of technocratic ways, with use of body cameras and so forth. And what this actually does is it re-legitimates the presence of police as an occupying force, and it poses the immediate danger of expanding the surveillance apparatus of the police, even while it attempts to reform and curb the armed and militia apparatus of the police. So you're correct that one of the central challenges, as it's always been, has been to disarticulate, that is to disrupt this naturalized connection between community security, community safety, and our own well-being from the existence of a racist state by virtue of its police force and its criminal justice apparatus. That's the ongoing abolitionist imperative.
But in the absence of a community that can provide its own security, that is actively working to do so, how do we engage this argument?
This is the exact challenge that I've been engaged with for about 20 years now. And my response to your question is a historically specific one, so don't take this as a one-size-fits-every-moment response. But my argument in this period has been that the primary method that we need to engage if we're going to carry on Black radical anti-colonial and abolitionist traditions, thought, and practices is that the abolitionist practice at this moment in history has to be pedagogical. We are not in position in most cases to actually create a sustainable infrastructure to push police out of our communities at this point. We're in a defensive posture. The police are heavily armed, they're overfunded, and just as importantly, if not more importantly, they have a virtual monopoly on cultural and ethical legitimacy in this country. So that tells me that our primary imperative is pedagogical. We have to engage in every possible form of ideological, theoretical, and historical education in our communities by way of art, poetry, engagement in churches and mosques. If we can get audiences with elementary school classrooms, if we can just do it at the dinner table, we need to be constantly trying to re-engage this conversation around what it is to be liberated and what it means to be liberated in a condition of safety and collective security. That means that what we need is a form of infrastructure that is a pedagogical infrastructure. Until we have some kind of traction to challenge the cultural normalcy of the police, we're going to constantly be repeating your words, which is that in the absence of, in the absence of, in the absence of something better. Well, I will say that we actually hold within our own capacity to talk and educate and teach and challenge a certain kind of infrastructure that doesn't require uniforms and policy. Right? This is stuff that we can do on a day-to-day level. It just requires a certain kind of commitment and also a refusal to concede that the police are a permanent and necessary part of our environment. So I would argue that the infrastructure currently that we can build is pedagogical. It's about political building a political culture, a shared political culture, a shared critical political culture that is constantly challenging the legitimacy of police and policing.
Well, certainly we can do more than that on the ground. We can create cop watches and cop watches that are consciously proto people's security units that understand that they would be the seeds of such a security system to replace, to push out the police at some point.
Absolutely. And we see this. We see this happening in multiple communities across the United States and even particularly in other parts of the world. In some places, it's out of necessity. And in many places, it's out of self-defense against a racist occupying police force. But CopWatch, that is building on the example of the Black Panther Party's self-defense phase and its initial foundations, you know, in Oakland and then eventually other parts of the country. Absolutely, the kind of grassroots movement to create forms of accountability that are not just about police accountability, but about interpersonal accountability within communities is a constant. There's multiple examples we can draw from, not only in cities, but also in sites of incarceration in prisons. There's multiple examples in prisons where incarcerated people have bonded with each other and realized that relying on prison guards to protect them is folly. And so what they have done in multiple instances across the country, I can think of a couple examples in the Northwest and a couple examples in the East Coast in New York State, in which what incarcerated people did was that they bonded with each other and they said, you know what, we're going to keep ourselves safe. And they created their own security force. They effectively delegitimated the force and the violence of the guards. And guess what? The people in those places respected that. And those forces became a far more effective security force than the armed and militarized state was. So you're correct that alongside the pedagogical infrastructure, there absolutely are grassroots forms that we can and should be doing and learning from that will push the state or at least mitigate the presence of the racist police forces in these different places. Absolutely.
In observing the trajectory of what's called the Black Lives Matter movement, how is abolition standing up in those quarters?
It's a complex movement. From what I see, there are various phases and different ideological and political commitments within that movement, as with any movement. The folks that I engage with the most are those who would be standing up and pushing for abolitionist principles within the Black Lives Matter formation. It's not a singular ideological imperative that guides that movement. It's a complexity. And so I'm seeing that abolitionist principles have guided the foundations of that movement just because I know the three co-founders identify themselves as abolitionists. What I think we need to be really clear about is that movements like this, as radical and as abolitionist as their origins might be, are always vulnerable to appropriation by nonprofit apparatuses, by foundations and by kind of liberal and reformist progressive apparatuses that would seek to mitigate the radical and liberationist edge that drives these organizations, that animates them and turns them into kind of really mundane but nonetheless grandstanding forms of policy reform. So I think it's a complexity, and I think that the radical elements of the Black Lives Matter formation and all of the corollary movements around it need to be honored and need to be elevated and constantly valued and pushed forward.
Well, do you see that kind of political struggle going on and on an organization-to-organization basis or within these organizations?
You named it. It's absolutely both of those things. And here's the thing. When we look at the political context in the cultural material sense that different movements unfold on in the United States context, the nonprofit industrial complex is inescapable. The nonprofit apparatus, meaning this kind of interplay between community organizations, liberal foundations and think tanks, and funders, they tend to hop onto any kind of grassroots movement. They try to funnel it into something that is fundable, that turns into a campaign instead of a social movement, that shifts accountability from the grassroots to foundations, and therefore, as you know, you probably expect, completely deteriorates and dilutes the potential radical and transformative animation of those movements. You see it every single time. And of course, our colleague, mentor, and guide, Robert Allen, wrote about this in his famous book, Black Awakening in Capitalist America. I mean, this is something that has its foundations in the white liberal and conservative states' reaction to the liberation movements of the latter 1960s and early 1970s. So we shouldn't be surprised by this. We should be prepared for it. And you see this kind of struggle happening all the time. And what I think is dangerous is that what can and should be a political struggle is oftentimes short-circuited and turned into a conversation around which funder and which nonprofit apparatus is most feasible, when in fact what we should be talking about are radical models, different models of accountability, sustainability, and reproduction.
The movement for Black Lives has received literally millions of dollars in recent years. Could this be one reason for what many perceive as a lessened militancy?
Yes. This is a systemic facet of being engaged in a progressive, transformative, and radical movement in this particular historical moment. This influx of funding and dollars, which then shifts accountability and shifts politics. What I will say is nonetheless important and critical about that trend is you've always got folks on the edges of all that. You've always got folks who are still fighting and sustaining their militancy on the borders of the mainstream of these movements. And the mainstream is a fabricated one, of course. This is the mainstream of these movements, something that's created, whether it's immigrant rights, Black Lives Matter, or something else. The mainstream is always something that's fabricated by the nonprofit funding apparatus. So at the very same time, there's people like you and me who will acknowledge the fact that there's a mainstream and continue to push against it and push against the harnessing of the radical and transformative components of the movement. And they're funneling into these campaign-based, reformist, short-circuited, and short-sighted imperatives. So I think that what you're identifying is absolutely materially and culturally a fact. And nonetheless, there's Black radical elements and other allied radical elements that are on the edges of that formation who continue to sustain themselves.
What you were speaking about, of course, is money talks, but the street talks too. And since 1935, yes, Black folks have consistently rebelled against police repression.
That's right. Here's the thing that you are putting your finger on is this kind of white liberal foundation nonprofit apparatus can do all it wants to try to harness Black radicalism, to try to harness Black insurgency and Black insurrection, and try to harness Black revolutionary militancy. It can and does do this all the time in any way that it can, right? That's why they send academics and offices like mine to go into these different hallways, to sit at those oak tables, and to negotiate different forms of alliance with these nonprofit structures that will put a lid on things. They do that all they want, and they have it deeply institutionalized. They have protocols for it, and they have billions of dollars to sustain it. But even with all that, as we know, Black insurrection is insurmountable, it is irrepressible, and it is a fundamental facet of Black life in this continent. So the contradiction that they cannot reconcile, that the nonprofit apparatus and the liberal reformist apparatus cannot reconcile with its mission, is the simple fact that insurgency, insurrection, and revolutionary liberationist spirit is a fundamental fact of Black life in North America. And so what is important for me as a student of Black liberation and Black radicalism, as somebody who is guided by it, is to identify when, where, and how that Black insurrection is happening. And it is sometimes happening in ways that aren't familiar to us, which means that then we have to re-educate ourselves. We have to understand the language of the insurrection is speaking, the art that it is producing, the sounds that it's making, and who it is that's embodying it, whether it's Black trans people, Black queer people, Black feminists and Black women, incarcerated Black people, or others, Black youth, you know, Black elders, whoever it might be. The ongoing, I think, analytical task and political task is to comprehend the shape that Black insurrection, radical, liberatory Black insurrection is taking in a certain moment and learn from it and be guided by it. So I think you're absolutely correct in identifying that that is a fundamental facet of Black life in this continent.
That was Professor Dylan Rodriguez of the University of California at Riverside.
In New York City, Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance says his office will stop prosecuting people for fare beating on the city's subways. But Mayor Bill de Blasio objects, claiming that turnstile jumping has nothing to do with poverty. Robert Ganji is executive director of the Police Reform Organizing Project, which monitors a court system where on any given day, 85 to 90% of the defendants are Black and brown, many of them charged with fare beating.
Our position is that the city should provide free fares for low-income people. And nobody can do well in our city, survive and thrive in our city, unless they use public transportation. And for some people, public transportation is a financial burden. Hundreds of thousands of poor people in the city really can't afford the subway fare, or they have to make a choice between taking the subway or not buying a meal for themselves or their children, for example. So we, along with a number of other people, were promoting either reduced fare or free fare for low-income New Yorkers, removing the police and the law enforcement apparatus entirely from the issue, and placing service-oriented people on the subway by the turnstile to, one, be a deterrent to people who were thinking about trying to sneak onto the subway, and also to offer their services. If people need to take the subway but are in a financial situation where they really can't afford it, to help them apply for free fares or help them figure out some way to get to where they have to go. So our approach would be to lend a hand. De Blasio's approach is to apply a hammer and a hurt to people. And he continually denies, despite the research that shows that the main reason that people jump to turnstiles is because it's a financial burden. He continues to say that most fare evaders actually have money, they can't afford it, and they're just taking advantage of a situation.
Yes, and it would seem to be quite obvious that people who don't have money but have some place to go may try to beat the fare.
Exactly. And the research shows that the vast majority of people who are jumping the turnstiles don't do it for the thrill of it, but do it because of their financial situation and that it is a financial stretch for them. And so knowing that, and knowing that everyone has to be able to use the subways in New York City to be able to have a decent life, the city's response, particularly the city's that is governed by a supposedly progressive mayor, are supposed to care about the plight of poor people and care about social injustice. The city's mayor should provide a helping hand to people rather than directing his police department to arrest people or to ticket people. It's important to note that last year there were almost 20,000 arrests for fare evasion. It's over an average of over 50 a day, 91% New Yorkers of color. So there's a stark racial bias associated with these arrests. Even with all that information that is before the public and certainly before the mayor, he continues to insist on hard line approach and a law enforcement approach rather than a social service oriented approach.
And of course, for many of these 20,000 arrests, it doesn't stop there. Every encounter with the police is an opportunity for one to earn a lifetime felony for some reason or other.
Right, right. Now, fare evasion is a misdemeanor in New York City, not a felony, but it is fare evasion arrest is part of the broken windows policing philosophy, and it is one essential way that the NYPD criminalizes New Yorkers who really aren't criminal, really aren't predatory, in the sense that most members of the public think about those terms. So the part of the problem with the de Blasio approach, to use a soundbite kind of statement, is that he's criminalizing poverty with this policy. And it's not an overstatement. It's all too true. And he has the power to have the city practice a different approach to the fare evasion issue.
What's your understanding of how the Manhattan District Attorney, Cyrus Vance, arrived at his policy of not prosecuting fare beaters?
Well, the Cy Vance situation is a little bit tricky because one of the activities of my organization, the Police Reform Organizing Project, or PROP, is to monitor the arraignment parts in the four major boroughs of New York City. And the arraignment parts are where everybody who's been arrested gets before a judge, and the judge determines whether whatever charge the DA brought and the police brought will stick. And we see that the Manhattan District Attorney is still prosecuting fare evasion cases. Maybe a reduced number, but he is still prosecuting fare evasion cases. So we're not even sure that Vance is following through in a meaningful way on his pledge. His public statement was to the effect that fare evasion is obviously not a serious criminal offense, and we shouldn't be criminalizing people. We shouldn't be giving people a criminal record who are poor and who are not engaging in any kind of activity that endangers public safety.
Yes, and if the cops actually oppose that policy and it's not firmly laid down, they'll continue to do what they like to do.
Right. Well, it's important to note that what the DA says in any borough in New York City doesn't affect police practice. So even if the DA is saying, I won't prosecute, and again, although Vance's statement would lead you to believe that's what he meant, we're not sure it's translated into practice on the ground in the Manhattan DA's office. But whatever public statement a DA makes about this or that practice on their part doesn't affect police tactics. So police will continue to arrest people for fare evasion no matter what the DA in any borough is saying. So people will still be subjected to arrest, which involves the loss of liberty at least for a day or so, if not more, because some fare evasion arrests, and we've seen this in Manhattan and the other boroughs, actually does result in jail time, where people get sentenced to Rikers Island for 10 days, 15 days.
Mayor de Blasio seems to be quite tight with the police nowadays. He was first seen by some as the great progressive hope, but you don't see him that way.
Not at all. No, he has, our judgment is that he has made a political decision that he will align himself with whatever activity or decision comes out of the police department. It really is that the police department and the people who run the police department are an unchecked power in New York City, not checked by the mayor, not checked by the city council, and can do whatever they decide to do, whether it's justified by any applicable criteria, and there's not going to be any pushback, not going to be any consequence. And it's a dangerous situation in New York City, particularly dangerous for the groups that the police department targets. And it's mainly low-income people of color and other people who live on the margins of our society, mentally ill people, homeless people, sex workers, street vendors. All those populations are targeted and harassed by the NYPD without any consequence to their abusive and discriminatory tactics.
Well, if the New York City police are unchecked by the mayor, unchecked by the city council, and they are the size of about three or four army divisions, one could truly call them an army of occupation.
I think in many of the low-income communities in the city, that's the way a lot of people in those neighborhoods experience the police, as an occupying army, not there to protect and serve them, but there to harass and punish them.
And you and your group regularly go into the courts to keep tabs on what the input into that system is, and it is overwhelmingly black and brown.
Right. We go to the arraignment parts on a regular basis. This past Tuesday night, we were in the night court in Manhattan, And whenever we go in, without exception, to Manhattan, Bronx, Brooklyn, or Queens, at least 85% of the arrested people who are being brought before the judge are New Yorkers of color. Sometimes it's 100%. The charges consistently are low-level infractions, typically marijuana possession, suspended license, petty larceny, fare evasion, disorderly conduct. Hardly any of the people brought before the judge, prosecutor, as a result of an NYPD arrest, could be considered dangerous or predatory. The question, essential question, is why are the police arresting these people in the first place? It's an extraordinary waste of resources. It's clearly marked by stark racial bias. The mayor has the power to end it because he could direct the NYPD to abolish broken windows policing, to abolish the quota system, which drives many of the NYPD police officers to make unnecessary arrests or give out bogus summonses because they have to make their quota.
And of course, the police claim that there is no quota system and the mayor right. sees no evil and hears no evil.
Right. So the police claim there's no quota system. It's like Bill Clinton saying, I didn't have sex with that woman. George Bush, the second George Bush, saying the United States is not torture. The police department has to issue misleading statements on that issue because quotas are illegal. So they spin it to say we don't have quotas, we have productivity goals. Again, there's no political entity in the city other than organizers and advocates who challenge the police department. Some members of the press do too, challenge the police department on their practices and on the misstatements they put forward as a way to cover up how those practices are abusive or illegal.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.